On today's episode, we're talking about observability, which is basically how you figure out why your microservices are crying at 3 a.m. in the morning.
We got to chat with Adriana, who's a principal developer advocate at Dynatrace, an OpenTelemetry maintainer, and apparently enjoys climbing walls when she's not instrumenting code.
She's also a CNCF ambassador who somehow finds time to podcast, blog, and contribute to open source while maintaining a full-time job. I'm exhausted just thinking about it.
We dive deep into OpenTelemetry, discuss why your observability teams shouldn't be instrumenting your code. Spoiler, developers, it's your job. And explore the eternal struggle between getting good observability data and not bankrupting your company.
And of course, David asked approximately 47 impossible questions about instrumentation strategies and cost optimization. Classic David.
Hey, at least I didn't ask about Rust this time.
True.
Though we did talk about environmental impact of observability, which was genuinely eye-opening.
We also learned that Sweden has the greenest data centers in the world and that swivel chair observability is not the goal. Who knew?
Enjoy the episode. Thank you so much for joining us today on Cognitive Compass, Adriana. For anyone who is not familiar with your work or you, could you please take a moment just to tell us what you're up to and what you enjoy?
Yeah, sure. So my name is Adriana Villela. I am a principal developer advocate at Dynatrace. I also have a podcast called Geeking Out. I blog a fair bit on Medium, and I work in the observability space. I have, for I guess the last couple of jobs, I'm heavily involved in OpenTelemetry. I'm one of the maintainers of the OTel end user SIG. And by night, I like to climb walls. I am into bouldering. I've sustained a few injuries over the years as a result, including I guess my most recent severe injury was an ankle sprain back at the end of October of 2024. So when I was at KubeCon in Salt Lake City, I was semi-limping around because I think I was like 2 or 3 weeks fresh off the injury. So I definitely practice
wow,
a dangerous
that's
sport.
Amazing. Very cool. A great hobby to be doing. I know there's quite an active bouldering and climbing community inside of the cloud native community as well. I know that Dan Finneran is always talking about trying to get people up the up hills or rock walls or whatever whenever we go to KubeCon. But I prefer the quiet, not breaking my ankle or spraining my ankle life. So I'll keep it this way. Anyway.
I don't blame you.
Yeah, just I'm your stereotypical geek. I prefer not to touch grass, but that's me. So anyway, let's get back on topic. There's no point in digressing right away off the bat, right? So you're a wonderful person. We've met before, and I did some research before we decided to record this as well, and ended up on your bio page on GitHub, and the amount of talks and panels and blogging and podcasting that you do is amazing. Like I can't believe the output and how much you're doing. So first of all, thank you for everything that you're doing for the observability, OpenTelemetry, and the cloud native space. But I'd love to know, just how do you manage to find the time to juggle this with a full-time job and be so present in the cloud native community?
I think, to be honest, I'm lucky that my job allows me to build that into what I do, because otherwise I think I'd need like clones of myself running around because it is a lot. And even with that, my days are definitely full, but I think it's really important. You know, I'm a CNCF ambassador, and for me, it was really important when I was looking for my next role to be able to build that into what I do, build the, you know, the contributions to OpenTelemetry into the role. So I was very thoughtful in my job selection process. This is my second developer advocacy role. So before that, I was a Java software developer for like 16 years. I've led teams off and on, you know, I've like manager, not manager, decided I don't want to be a manager. I'm much happier as an IC. You know, when I was looking for my next developer advocacy role, a lot of very nice, well-meaning friends kept just throwing like whatever DevRel role they saw, and it's like database DevRel and like networks related DevRel, and it's like, cool, but that's not really my passion. So I wanted to make sure that I got to continue doing the same things that I was super passionate about and interested in. And I mean, I've spent, you know, I've been in tech for 24 plus years, but, you know, all the stuff that you listed, I've only done in the last like three-ish years since I've become a developer. And it feels like this awakening of my career that I hadn't, you know, I didn't even know tech could be cool like that until I got into cloud native and developer advocacy. So yeah, I definitely credit my employer for allowing me to build that stuff into my job, because otherwise that would be a lot to do.
There's this kind of common misconception about developer relations and advocacy that, you know, we just go around conferences on our private jets and, you know, jump on a stage, have a drink, and it's like so easy. But it is a hard life trying to be that present with so many people and so many communities. And it's hard to say this, right? You know, but traveling is hard, full stop. Doing it with intent to educate and inspire and help people and be engaging, it's a tough gig. So yeah, I don't envy that anymore. I've not been in DevRel for a while. It was tough, especially I've got two young kids. So traveling a lot was very hard as well. Anyway.
Yeah. With that age, it's
we're about a month now after KubeCon in London, and I'm just going to bring up a couple of the conversations that I had there with people, because I think it leads us in nicely to what we want to talk about, which is observability. Now, every year we go to KubeCon, they do the keynotes, they ask the question of how many people are brand new to Kubernetes and cloud native, and it's an overwhelming show of hands year on year. This year, no exception, with 12,500 people. People are new to microservices, cloud native, Kubernetes, containers, all of this. And they get promised this ideology that if we work in microservices, their jobs and their lives will be easier because they're slinging less code with less responsibilities and all of this. But there's the downside of microservice and cloud native, which is you now have 12,000 applications to keep running, an arbitrary number I'm throwing out there. And you need to know when that's broken. And I think the classic example that I love to talk about with people is like, if you have a monolith, you stick a health endpoint on it, and if it returns a 200, you can kind of assume that the application is running okay. When you have many microservices, understanding the health of a whole application is almost impossible to a certain degree. But then there's healthy for what actions and what systems, what personas, et cetera. And this is where I think people need to start diving into observability and understanding how do we bring a little bit of sanity to the chaos that is a distributed system. And there's obviously observability. There's this recent conversation about observability 2.0. There's OpenTelemetry. There's a lot of moving parts in this space. And you're the expert. So for the people that are listening to this and they are on that journey to cloud native, can you help them? How do they bring some sleep? How do they get more sleep while shipping microservice cloud native applications? Sorry, that's a pure wide arching broad question, but you know, good luck.
Yeah, I think you hit it spot on. Like, you know, with microservices architectures, now you've got all these moving parts. Like, you have so many moving parts interacting with each other, and it's sometimes unpredictable. What might seem okay on the surface is like some weird ass crap going on deep down below that you might not be aware of. And, you know, observability is the way to help surface that, right? And especially with distributed traces, I know, you know, observability itself has been a bit of a journey, right? Because I think a lot of people, they started with like traditional monitoring, which is like very sort of a reactive thing, and it's very like metrics based and you know, logs based and all that, and that's great. And you know, we got to start somewhere. But then observability kind of opened the doors and basically said, hey, you know what, let's look at everything in terms of, you know, like distributed traces. I see the distributed traces the star of observability, because it gives us that end-to-end view of what's going on, right, from start to finish. You know, I love using the example of like you're shopping for shoes, you click on the button that says add to cart, and you know, you have a distributed trace that captures exactly what happens from the minute you click on that add to cart to when the item is added to your cart. And the trace shows you exactly what is going on in each step of the way, right? Right down to those database calls. And then you've got like your supporting actors, you've got your metrics and you've got your logs telling us, hey, these are the things that happened along the way, along that journey, right? They're almost like little bookmarks, point in time captures of what's going on. And then you've got your metrics, which tell us things like, how long did it take to get from this service call to this service call? How long did we spend time waiting on that database to return? We can even take it more broadly and look at like, how many shoes did we sell in the month of November compared to December? And is it because we saw some like performance blips because maybe November was busier than December, December was busier than November? So having that overall view of what is going on, I think helps make life so much easier. And what I will say with observability is I think, and I've written about this recently, I think sometimes observability is treated as like this sort of adjacent thing. It's either like an adjacent to like SRE thing, or it's like, oh, it's an SRE concern. And it's like, yeah, it will definitely help your SREs understand your system, but like everyone has a part to play, right? I mean, someone's instrumenting your code. It's got to be the developers. You're not going to ask your SRE team to do it. And or like my pet peeve favorite, the observability team will instrument your code and create dashboards for you. It's like, bro, I don't know what you're what you need. Like, I don't have that context. So how can you ask an observability team to do that? Developers need to instrument their own code. In instrumenting their code, it enables them to troubleshoot their own code, first of all. So two for the price of one. Secondly, when you hand off that code for testing, your testers can go in and say, oh, I found a bug. Because the developers have instrumented the code, they can go in and say, hey, I found a bug and I know where it is. Or they can go, I found a bug, I don't know where it is. Developers, you need to go back and instrument the code because I don't have visibility into what's going on. And then by the time it gets to the SREs, hopefully, you know, if there's an incident or whatever, they have the information required to troubleshoot. It's not going to be perfect. Observability is an iterative process, but everyone has a part to play, right? And I think that's the thing that people need to really keep in mind. I also take issue with so-called observability teams, because oftentimes companies will spin up observability teams as like the catch-all of like, you will take care of all things observability, including instrumenting code and creating dashboards. And I was running an observability practices team at Two Cows, and I had to push back a lot because our team kept being asked to instrument code and create dashboards. I'm like, this is not what we do. We are the experts on observability. We'll tell you what practices you need to follow to instrument your code. We can give you guidance. We'll come up with the company-wide standards, because I think you need to have some sort of standard oversight around it. But like, this is not a, we do your work for you. You have to do your work for you. Like, a developer writes log statements. So what's the difference between like that and adding like some traces to your code? It's just like you have to wrap your mind around it, right? Because everything new, like there is the tendency for resistance. There's the, yeah, oh my God, there's the learning curve. I have to learn yet another thing. It's overwhelming. But then I look at it and like, if your house is on fire, are you going to keep building the living room?
Yeah, nope. You would hope so.
Sure hope not. Take the time to learn this stuff. Right? Learn the observability stuff so you can save yourself. Save your house. Yeah, put out the fire.
It's funny when you talk about observability teams, and it takes me back. Like, you know, I mean, you've been in this industry, like you said, for 20 odd years. So when DevOps was gaining ground, every company in Scotland was hiring DevOps people and DevOps teams. And you're like, hold on, you've kind of missed the important message of what you're supposed to be doing here. You can't just stick it on a job title and say problem solved. That's not what we're trying to do. So there's,
right,
like I said, it's an iterative process. So with that in mind, and there's so many avenues we could go down here, right? But let's kind of start from the idea that people are trying to do the migration to cloud native. I think it's very rare that people have, they start with a microservice architecture or a cloud native architecture. They have something that's old and they want to modernize it. What does it mean then to instrument your code? You know, when we talk about adding traces and metrics and hopefully logging already exists for these companies, I hope so. Hopefully it's centralized. You know, this isn't 1994 anymore, but what is the starting point? And I know there's ways to do this with auto instrumentation and manual instrumentation. So maybe we can touch on what is the approach today in 2025.
Yeah, that's a great point. And as you pointed out, there are two ways using OpenTelemetry, which is, you know, the CNCF standard. It's the CNCF tool, which has become, I would say, the de facto standard for instrumenting applications. It has the backing of most of the major observability vendors. It's got the second highest number of contributions behind Kubernetes. So, and it's massive. It's incredible. And it's, you know, very sort of thoughtful community where, you know, there isn't this attitude of like one vendor, it reigns supreme over all of them. It, by design, it's like, vendor neutrality is the message. I work with competitors all the time. I don't see them as competitors. They're friends. And we're all working towards a common goal. So with instrumenting with OpenTelemetry, as you said, there's two forms of instrumentation, right? There's the manual instrumentation, and then there's the auto or zero code instrumentation. And as the name implies, zero code instrumentation really means you are not touching the code to instrument it. There's usually like some sort of a wrapper around your code. So like for Python or Java, which I've worked with, there is like a Python or Java wrapper around your code, which then will inject the auto instrumentation for your code. And especially like if you're using libraries that have been auto instrumented, like Python Flask, for example, you don't have to like go in and instrument your requests because that's already taken care of for you. So you apply this wrapper and then magic, you send your data to your OpenTelemetry collector, which is a vendor neutral agent that is basically like, it's basically an ETL tool. It ingests OTel data, transforms, and then spits it out to a somewhere, which can be an observability vendor. And the magic, it magically appears. And then you see your traces on there. And, you know, zero code instrumentation is a great starting point, I think, because, you know, it is low effort, but you can get into some, a little bit of trouble with zero code instrumentation in the sense that like you can end up with more data than you bargained for, more data than is relevant to you. Unfortunately, with zero code instrumentation, there is a way to like turn off, like for certain libraries, for example, hey, I don't want to instrument everything in this library. So you turn off the noise. And, you know, and then beyond that, I think you need to go in and start manually instrumenting the code, because zero code instrumentation makes the decision for you, right? Like it deems like this is important for instrumentation. That is what's going to happen. Manual instrumentation requires you to be a lot more thoughtful, right? Because I think it's going to be one of those things where it's kind of like creating an SLO, right? It's like you take a stab and you keep refining it, right? So you're going to start, you know, adding traces in the same way that you like add a log to your code, right? There you select a chunk of code that your trace is going to apply to. And you can add attributes, you can add what's called span events, which is like a log embedded into your span. And so that's how you go about it. And it really is a process, I would say, as the developer is going along, they can use the process of debugging their own code to sort of understand what are the pieces that would be important for instrumenting. And I would say the same thing for metrics. I think for metrics, a lot of the time, things that are really important to us are things like how long is the span? And the span, it basically represents an operation or a process. So you want to capture that kind of information, which can be derived from a span, by the way. And then you can create metrics for other things that you may deem important. You know, you've got your typical ones like your CPU and your RAM usage. And then other things, like I mentioned, like in our shoe example, like how many shoes are we processing per month? And so it's going to be, you know, it's going to be that kind of process. You don't have to boil the ocean. I think when instrumenting code, especially when you're instrumenting existing code, by the very act of instrumenting existing code, you're basically introducing technical debt into it. It's just the way it is, right? You're adding new code. It is code, so you're probably opening yourself up to bugs as a result, right? Because you can goof up when you're instrumenting. And so you just have to kind of be mentally prepared for like what to expect when you're instrumenting so that you're not like, oh my God, I thought this was going to be so much easier. And then all of a sudden, like it's 10 times harder than you expected. Like manage your expectations. I think that's super important. And then, so there's that, like manage those expectations. But then also the other thing is like one sort of like quick win is instrument your homegrown libraries and frameworks, because chances are your code touches a lot of that. So now you're getting kind of like you're instrumenting a bunch of stuff automatically just by doing that. And then the other one is any new code that you're writing, instrument that as you go along in the same way that you would add log statements as you're going along. Just get into that habit. Like, you know, we've gotten, hopefully many have gotten in the habit of test-driven development. Think of it as the same way. It's called observability-driven development. You're instrumenting as you go along. So if you forge that habit right away, then at least like the new code will be taken care of. I'm not going to lie. It's not an easy process. It's not like a waving a magic wand. I guess auto instrumentation is more like that waving a magic wand, but it'll only take you so far. And that's why you do eventually have to go into that
awesome.
Manual
Thank
instrumentation.
Thank you so much. So like, first of all, let's clarify a couple of things. So OpenTelemetry, as you said, is now almost ubiquitous within this space. I think this is the standard that everyone should be building on. It supports Go, TypeScript, Rust, Python. Like, I think any language that people are listening to this and thinking I write in this is probably covered, and I would assume at least pretty good support. Now, there's the manual instrumentation. Let's focus on that. The auto instrumentation is there for people that want to experiment. But, you know, as you said, the value comes from you deciding where to create spans and events and all of this stuff. And we can get into the cost of observability as we kind of get into this conversation. But the challenge is we're building distributed systems. We've got network traffic. We've got other services. These things we have to correlate as a request comes in through the front door and all the way through the system. And this is where OpenTelemetry and traces are so important. But we're seeing now that people can use this information to do spans within a single service. So this is function calls and probably just function calls, I guess. But even in business defense, you talked about shoes, and I don't know if that's a real example that you've seen in the wild before, but yeah, why not if you have an e-commerce store emit event information on business domains, right? Because there's analytics within all this too that can be propagated up to some other system. So this is a challenge, and I don't want to ask like an impossible question, but when is too much, right? Like, how do people work out what is important to instrument and what isn't? Is there a heuristic that you would say helps people be successful when they, you know, taking a new function and adding a span to it? Is that always the right approach? How do I turn that off? And what is the cost of infinitely adding these to every single function within my application across hundreds of different services? And again, sorry, that's a really tough question as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's a lot to unpack, but a really good point. I think, you know, I think the best way to answer the question, it's always, it depends, right? And I think the best way to answer the question, though, is to look back at the definition of observability. And I've been quoting this definition a lot. It's from Hazel Weekly, and I think it's a great definition because it encompasses so much. So observability allows us to ask meaningful questions, get useful answers, and act effectively on that information. If you're finding yourself at a point where you can't ask the questions, you can't get the answers from that, or you can't act effectively on the information, like any of these, any combination of these, then you need to go back to the drawing board and revisit your instrumentation. Now, then you mentioned the cost aspect, and that's tricky, right? Because the temptation is to like add distributed tracing to everything, spans to everything, and that can get very costly, not just from a dollar sign standpoint, but from an environmental standpoint as well, right? Because any of these things uses up energy, and, you know, data centers suck up a lot of energy. They add a fair bit to the carbon footprint, and it's only going up. Especially when we consider things like AI, You know, it's a double-edged sword, right? Lots of compute. So, and it's not just like you, your application generating the telemetry. It's also the ingest of the telemetry, right? So whether or not you're sending it to, you know, a homegrown observability tool that you, you know, like running like a self-hosted observability setup on your, in your own data centers, or whether it's a SaaS tool. And even like as a little sidebar, like I did a talk at KubeCon on like, you know, examining like, can we tune the hotel collector so that it consumes less energy? And as part of the talk, one of the things that my talk partner, Nancy Chauhan, and I researched was we looked at like, you know, depending on where your data center is hosted, it can use up less energy. And fun fact, Sweden, the data centers there are like the greenest data centers in the world. So yeah, like we've got, you know, we've got our dollar sign costs, we've got our environmental costs. For the dollar sign costs, I think it's a matter of being very mindful and effective with your observability data. Like, what are you sending over? And I think one of the ways to do that is to limit what you send through sampling. Another interesting thing that I've seen suggested is to use feature flags. So for example, if maybe you want to instrument all the things, but maybe you have feature flags that turn off like instrumentation until like things start going caca, and maybe you want to switch on those feature flags so you have that like extra bit of visibility, so you can see like all of the things that are going wrong. And then once you've like figured out what the problem is, then you can shut off those feature flags and then limit what's being emitted to your observability backend for analysis. So those two things can definitely help.
I guess it's easy for us to overmiss the environmental impacts. I'm glad you brought that up and mentioned that. Like, it is really important. And you know, you said mm-hmm. AI, but yeah, that is literally consuming the environment right now. So we need to be a bit more careful with these decisions. There's also mm-hmm. the dollar cost you talked about as well. And the one you mentioned earlier is the technical debt as well. Like, you know, if people are, and companies and teams are building libraries to do auto, you know, manual, but auto instrumentation for the downstream consumers, they're automatically getting all of these spans and events that they don't really know exist unless they dig into it. So like, yeah, there's so many considerations. It's really, it's a hard problem for people to get right. And the thing I like there, you mentioned the quote from Hazel, is that, you know, if you're not asking these questions yet, you probably shouldn't be instrumenting it, although then you're into a path of resiliency engineering. I don't know, when things are broken and you ask a question, you work backwards and you instrument it and you move forward. Like, I don't know, there must be some sort of golden path here, but that's not something we're going to solve on a mm-hmm. 40-minute podcast. So we'll move on. Now, this is great. I think, you know, people got a good idea of everything they're doing now, right? Traces, spans, events, open telemetry. They're happy. They're like, yes, I'm going to do this. This is perfect. It supports my language. I've got a collector. And I'm laughing all the way to sleep now. But unfortunately, there's still a lot of things to consider. Now, there's so many databases where you can put this telemetry data, right? I think there's the Tempo project from Grafana. There's all the SaaS companies like Dynatrace and Datadog and New Relic. There's the Jaeger. I don't even know what database they use, or if they have their own database, but there's Jaeger for the tracing stuff as well. When it comes to the technology stack beyond the specification of open telemetry, how do people make the decision of where do I put this data? How do I visualize it? And, you know, is there a right or wrong answer to any of that?
Well, that's a great question. And I think it boils down to a personal choice, right? Because I think because open telemetry is a standard, it means that all of these vendors that support open telemetry are ingesting the same data. So now what differentiates one vendor from another is what do they do with your data that makes it useful to you, that allows you to ask those questions, get those answers, and act effectively on the information. And so it becomes a matter of personal choice at that point, right? Because there might be a feature from a particular vendor where you're like, oh my God, this thing is blowing my mind and I cannot live without it. In which case, you know, it's kind of a no-brainer. But you also, I guess, have to balance that with cost, right? Because some vendors are more expensive than others. Some vendors can be more expensive than others if you don't do your sampling properly and just like instrument all the things. That can add up a fair bit. So these are the types of things to consider when going with a vendor. The other thing that you mentioned that I've seen even in use cases that I've read or like, you know, I review CFPs for KubeCon. I've done it a number of times, and it's interesting to see the number of proposals that come in that talk about, and we use this tool for logs and this tool for metrics and this tool for traces. And my thought is, you know, I feel like you're not getting the most out of your observability story here in doing so, because you don't have like a single data store, and you don't have not only a single data store, but a single place where you can correlate all the data in one place. So I think a lot of organizations end up losing out as a result, either because they're using a tool that doesn't support all three main telemetry signals, i.e. the traces, logs, metrics, or they've decided, you know, because of some legacy, whatever, oh, you know, like we send our logs to Elastic and our metrics go to Prometheus and then our traces go to Jaeger. And it's like, okay. And so now, you know, and I'm going to borrow a term from my husband, which describes it perfectly. You're doing swivel chair observability, where you're swinging from one system to another, back and forth, trying to correlate this stuff, where you should be doing the put your feet up on your desk observability, where you should be able to see everything in the same interface, everything nicely correlated, you know, our single pane of glass observability. And that's, I think, what we should be aspiring to. And I think the vendors that provide that single pane of glass observability and the organizations that embrace that, because some organizations are using vendors that support all three signals, provide the single pane of glass observability, but are still, you know, forking different signals to different backends. So I think those are the ones that are going to get the most out of their observability.
I'm going to ask this question in two ways. Let's start with the first one. We understand, I think it's very obvious now, right? There is a cost. You can't just write every single span and event to a SaaS provider, because the cost will be, I mean, it can be pretty, pretty large. Have you seen in practice people taking a tiered approach to this, where say maybe they have like a Grafana, what do they call it these days? Loki, Grafana, LGTP, I don't know, Mimer. Yeah.
I think it's Mimer, LGTM.
So do people do that for like high frequency, high fidelity data that lives for an hour, where they can sample it based on success rates and then push the outliers or anomalies to a SaaS for them to do their magic, right? Like, nobody's ever saying that Dynatrace and Datadog and New Relic don't offer exceptional product. It's just very expensive. Like, is there a way where I can say, okay, I'm going to write everything here locally on a big chunky bare metal machine, and I'm going to condense that down and send everything else, and then take advantage of Dynatrace to understand what went wrong with the things that are really important? Like, is that something you've seen in practice? Does it work? And should people aspire to that in some capacity?
I have seen, so in my last job before I got into DevRel, that's something that one of my teams was trying to do when I was managing the observability practices team at 2Cows. We were looking at basically long-term storage of logs, for example, and not doing it through the SaaS vendor that we were paying. And we were looking at like self-storage of logs using like an open source tool to enable that, for two reasons. A, it gets really expensive. And B, we wanted to make sure that we had that storage for compliance reasons, right? And that's another thing that organizations need to consider, because I think that's why a lot of the times they'll also want that long-term storage. Because I think some observability companies initially were like, oh, we'll only store your data for a few days, because, you know, observability is in the here and now. We want to kind of, if the problem's happening now, that's what we want to be able to troubleshoot. But what if you want to go back and look at history? Or as I said, like for compliance purposes, you need to retain the data for whatever reason. It's where it gets very expensive. And then that's where, you know, because OpenTelemetry gives you that flexibility via the OTel collector, where you can basically send your data to multiple destinations, then you can send your stuff to X SaaS vendor for your here and now analysis, and then your long-term storage of, like, say, logs to whatever, like, open source tool, and maybe something that compresses your data, so that you're because you're still paying for storage, it's just internally in your own stack. That's definitely an option.
Awesome. Yeah, I think that's a good pattern. I mean, again, I'll lean on my own experience here, and my OpenTelemetry observability knowledge is very poor, right? So you'll need to fill in some gaps here. But 6 years ago, when I worked at Influx, it was just working with time series data. And one of the really cool things that we could do there is I could store samples every 10 seconds and keep that for 24 hours. And we'd enter a downsampling loop, which is, okay, that data was useful for 24 hours. Anything after that up to 3 months, we only want the resolution to be maybe every 5 minutes, because that average over that time is valuable enough to us. Is this something that's even possible with traces? I mean, obviously metrics that can be done, because it's just, you know, vanilla time series data, but traces are very different. And I've heard of a term that I don't fully understand, so maybe you can fill me in as well. But people talk about exemplars, and maybe that ties into this conversation. I'm not really sure, but what's your thoughts on that?
Oh yeah, so exemplars, at least in the context of OpenTelemetry, is about correlating, okay, like your metric to your trace. And that one's kind of an interesting one, because it's only been fleshed out for, I think it's been a while since I've checked it out, but for Java and experimentally for .NET and nowhere else.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Okay. Maybe a bit too soon then to be kicking the tires on that. Yeah.
Yeah, that's still a work in progress. That's still a work in progress. But yeah, that's kind of an interesting one. But yeah, that's my understanding of exemplars from what I've seen in OTel. But yeah, I mean, in terms of like tweaking the granularity of traces, I think it's really, I guess, a matter of like, do you store all the traces, okay, or some of the traces? So then I think it becomes kind of a sampling.
What about them with the dimensionality or cardinality of these traces? Like, you know, I think Charity Majors has been vocal about how we should have lots of different properties on a trace, revealing as much information as we can. But that feels to me something that gets very costly very quickly as well. And the value of that data 3 months from now might not be as high as it was 3 seconds after the actual trace. Like, I'm assuming, I don't. Yeah.
Yeah, that one's an interesting one, because I think she's right in the sense that it's good to have as much information about our traces as possible. But then again, you run into it's a data storage problem. And I think like different observability vendors will charge you on the data differently. So maybe like having high dimensionality might be cost effective if you're working with one vendor, and then you switch over to another vendor and all of a sudden it's like your costs have blown up. So that's the other thing to consider as well. Like, it's, you know, you're still capturing the same data, but do you need to tweak your data because now it's not so pocketbook friendly?
All right. I'm sure that people listen to this. I don't know if we're helping people or scaring the absolute crap out of them.
Just confusing them.
Yeah.
It's like, it depends. I'm sorry.
All right. Well, let's change tack a little bit.
I swear observability is worth it.
Well, let's change tack a little bit, right? I mean, I think you've done a great job of explaining observability, OpenTelemetry, and, you know, all the bits and the nuts and bolts, the lexicon that people need to understand. But you have been in developer advocacy now for a while, and I'm curious, you know, what are some of the lessons learned that you've seen as you've personally adopted OpenTelemetry or spoken to other people doing it, right? Like, how can people be successful? Do you have any tips, like, or even just general advice of how to get started beyond NPM install or go mod get or whatever it is they're using?
I think, first of all, for learning OpenTelemetry, the best way to learn is based on how you learn best, right? We actually have a series on as part of the OTel and User Sig called OTel Me, and we have different OTel practitioners come on and talk about their experiences with using OpenTelemetry. And we had a guest last week, Hermosele Akibhe. And he got into OpenTelemetry through Outreachy, and he was talking about his journey into OpenTelemetry. And he said for him, like, he's a visual learner, so he really craved having like those videos explaining how things worked for him. And then the videos kind of gave him enough of an overview where he's like, okay, these are the topics that I want to dig deeper into. And then he dove into the docs, into the OTel docs for more information. Obviously, I think in an ideal world, I would love it for everyone to go to the OTel docs as their, you know, one-stop shop for all things OTel. But, you know, docs aren't perfect. I think the folks running the OTel docs team are fantastic and are doing a really great job in you know, constantly improving the docs. But I think in some cases, some people don't find the docs useful enough as a starting point. So then they'll, you know, I honestly, Google is your best friend. and I will, you know, there's like so many people writing about OpenTelemetry from various walks of life, whether it's, you know, blogs from observability vendors or personal blogs. Like I myself documented my own OpenTelemetry journey. I was like learning in public as I was, you know, I was managing this observability practices team. And I'm like, oh, damn it. I don't know anything about observability. I'm going to learn and I'm going to blog about it as I go. And it's, I guess DevRel was like perfect for me in that sense. I think, like I said, Google is your best friend because there's like a wealth of resources from videos to blog posts. I think having these good overview, either videos or blog posts, to sort of give you an idea of what those base concepts are for OpenTelemetry are great, because then you can use that to, like, as Hermosele did in his journey, dig deep, you know, go into the docs and dig deep on a particular topic. So it sort of helps to direct your learning journey. I'm also going to do a shameless plug here. I do have an O'Reilly video course on observability with OpenTelemetry. So if you have an O'Reilly subscription, you can check it out if you're a visual learner. So yeah, I mean, tons of resources. There's, you know, also I think my former colleagues Ted Young and Austin Parker have a great book on OpenTelemetry as well. There, I mean, the sky's the limit. It's a matter of like, I think having a good getting started resource of like, these are the main concepts, and then these are the things that I need to dive into is really awesome. The moral of the story.
And it's not a shameless plug if it's super valuable to people. So I'll make sure all these links are in the description for people to click on and make it easier. And lastly, obviously you are a CNCF ambassador, you are an OTel contributor, you're in this space. What if someone is listening to this and going, you know what, I want to help. I want to join this mission to make OpenTelemetry easier for people. How can they get involved and how can they contribute to the project?
Ooh, amazing. Yes, great question. So I'll send you afterwards. I have a blog post that I wrote on how to contribute to OpenTelemetry from my viewpoint as someone who was in those shoes. But in a nutshell, basically, you know, first of all, join CNCF Slack. In CNCF Slack, there are gajillions of OTel channels. Like, they all start with OTel dash. Pick an area of OpenTelemetry that interests you. So for example, you want to learn more about the OTel SDK, or maybe like you are a Pythonista and you would love to contribute more to OpenTelemetry Python. Join those channels that interest you and just, you know, monitor the conversations. Just be an observer, fly on the wall. Join the SIG meetings. You don't have to be actively involved. You can just sit and observe. If you're looking for more active involvement, but are afraid of, you know, touching code at this point, not because you can't code, but because contributing to an open source project can be overwhelming, a great place to get started is always in the docs. Because as I've said, you know, I would love for the OTel docs to be like, you know, the book of record for all things OTel. And the only way for that to happen is to have people who have used OpenTelemetry and have found a gap in the docs and have made and make an effort to contribute back to the docs. Like, for example, I was doing some research for my KubeCon talk on like the OTel, the greener OTel collector. And I was using this tool called the OpenTelemetry Collector Builder. And I went to the OTel docs for some guidance on it, and I got stuck. And again, Google was my friend. I phoned a friend, got some help. And then I'm like, and then I wrote a blog post about like what I did. But then I'm like, well, I want to be a good open source citizen. So I actually made a point of contributing back to the docs with the stuff that I learned so that people wouldn't be stuck like I was as well when they go back to the docs. And I'm happy to say the PR was merged last week. So that always makes me happy. So it's such a great way. But, you know, bottom line, it's such a great way to contribute to OpenTelemetry in that way. Joining the OTel end user SIG is also a great way. Even if you're not necessarily an end user per se, it's a great way to contribute because we have tons of things that we run as part of the SIG. Like I mentioned, we have this OTel Me series. So we're always looking for people to contribute, to interview. We have OTel in Practice where, you know, if you have an interesting OTel topic that you want to talk about and want to present on, you maybe want to test out a talk. You know, you wrote a talk, you want to flesh it out, use this as a guinea pig. So you can join that. We work with the SIGs to run surveys. So we liaise with the SIGs. And so we've got a couple of people who joined recently who have taken on that mantle of like really streamlining our survey process. There's always stuff to be done. And so if you're looking for a way to contribute, that's a great way to get started.
Awesome. Fantastic advice. Yeah. All right. I think that is now us at time. Do you have any last words for the audience before we say goodbye?
I would say, you know, don't be shy about contributing to open source, especially OpenTelemetry when you're submitting your first PR. Don't feel overwhelmed because everyone has been nothing but nice to me and to others that I've talked to since contributing to OpenTelemetry. The comments are always thoughtful. No one is ever aggressive or rude. So it makes me want to contribute more. So don't be afraid because this is honestly like a wonderful community. And if there's one CNCF community that I recommend that you join, and of course I am very biased, I would say definitely join OTel. We are
well, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us.
If you want to keep up with us, consider subscribing to the podcast on your favorite podcasting app, or even go to cloudnativecompass.fm.
And if you want us to talk with someone specific or cover a specific topic, reach out to us on any social media platform.
Until next time, when exploring the cloud native landscape, on three.
On three.
One, two, three. Don't forget your compass.
Don't forget your compass.